questo scure gelido.
3. I looked at him, lost in astonishment. There he was before me, in motley, as though he had absconded from a troupe of mimes, enthusiastic, fabulous. His very existence was improbable, inexplicable, and altogether bewildering. He was an insoluble problem. It was inconceivable how he had existed, how he had succeeded in getting so far, how he had managed to remain, why he did not instantly disappear. "I went a little farther," he said, "then still a little farther, till I had gone so far that I don't know how I'll ever get back. Never mind, plenty time. I can manage. You take Kurtz away quickly. Quick, I tell you." The glamour of youth enveloped his particolored rags, his destitution, his loneliness, the essential desolation of his futile wanderings. For months, for years, his life hadn't been worth a day's purchase. And there he was, gallantly, thoughtlessly alive, to all appearance indestructible, solely by the virtue of his few years and of his unreflecting audacity. I was seduced into something like admiration, like envy. Glamour urged him on, glamour kept him unscathed. He surely wanted nothing from the wilderness but space to breathe in and to push on through. His need was to exist and to move onwards at the greatest possible risk and with a maximum of privation. If the absolutely pure, uncalculating, unpractical spirit of adventure had ever ruled a human being, it ruled this bepatched youth. I almost envied him the possession of this modest and clear flame. It seemed to have consumed all thought of self so completely that even while he was talking to you, you forget that it was he, the man before your eyes, who had gone through these things. I did not envy him his devotion to Kurt, though. He had not meditated over it. It came to him, and he accepted it with a sort of eager fatalism. I must say that to me it appeared about the most dangerous thing in every way he had come upon so far. They had come together unavoidably, like two ships becalmed near each other, and lay rubbing sides at last. I suppose Kurtz wanted an audience, because on a certain occasion, when encamped in the forest, they had talked all night, or more probably Kurtz had talked. "We talked of everything," he said, quite transported at the recollection. "I forgot there was such a thing as sleep. The night did not seem to last an hour. Everything, everything. Of love, too." "Ah, he talked to you of love," I said, much amused. "It isn't what you think," he cried, almost passionately. "It was in general. He made me see things, things." He threw his arms up. We were on deck at the time, and the headman of my woodcutters, lounging nearby, turned upon him his heavy and glittering eyes. I looked around, and I don't know why, but I assure you that never, never before did this land, this river, this jungle, the very arch of this blazing sky, appear to me so hopeless and so dark, so impenetrable to human thought, so pitiless to human weakness. "And ever since you have been with him, of course," I said. "On the contrary, it appears their intercourse had been very much broken by various causes. He had, as he informed me proudly, managed to nurse Kurtz through two illnesses. He alluded to it as he would to some risky feat. But as a rule, Kurtz wandered alone, far in the depths of the forest. Very often coming to this station, I had to wait days and days before he would turn up," he said. "Ah, it was worth waiting for sometimes." "What was he doing? Exploring or what?" I asked. "Oh yes, of course. He had discovered lots of villages, a lake too. He did not know exactly in what direction. It was dangerous to inquire too much, but mostly his expeditions had been for ivory." "But he had no goods to trade with by that time," I objected. "There's a good lot of cartridges left even yet," he answered, looking away. "To speak plainly, he raided the country," I said. He nodded. "Not alone, surely?" He muttered something about the villages round that lake. "Kurt's got the tribe to follow him, did he?" I suggested. He fidgeted a little. "They adored him," he said. The tone of these words was so extraordinary that I looked at him searchingly. It was curious to see his mingled eagerness and reluctance to speak of Kurtz. The man filled his life, occupied his thoughts, swayed his emotions. "What can you expect?" he burst out. "He came to them with thunder and lightning, you know, and they had never seen anything like it, and very terrible. He could be very terrible." "You can't judge Mr. Kurtz as you would an ordinary man." "No, no, no. Now, just to give you an idea, I don't mind telling you, he wanted to shoot me too one day, but I don't judge him."
"Shoot you?" I cried. "What for?"
"Well, I had a small lot of ivory the chief of that village near my house gave me. You see, I used to shoot game for them. Well, he wanted it, and wouldn't hear reason. He declared he would shoot me unless I gave him the ivory and then cleared out of the country, because he could do so, and had a fancy for it. And there was nothing on earth to prevent him killing whom he jolly well pleased. And it was true, too. I gave him the ivory. What did I care? But I didn't clear out. No, no, I couldn't leave him. I had to be careful, of course, till we got friendly again for a time. He had his second illness then. Afterwards I had to keep out of the way, but I didn't mind. He was living, for the most part, in those villages on the lake. When he came down to the river, sometimes he would take to me, and sometimes it was better for me to be careful. This man suffered too much. He hated all this, and somehow he couldn't get away. When I had a chance, I begged him to try and leave while there was time. I offered to go back with him, and he would say yes, and then he would remain. Go off on another ivory hunt, disappear for weeks, forget himself amongst these people, forget himself, you know.
"Why, he's mad," I said.
He protested indignantly.
"Mr. Kurtz couldn't be mad. If I had heard him talk only 2 days ago, I wouldn't dare hint at such a thing."
I had taken up my binoculars while we talked, and was looking at the shore, sweeping the limit of the forest at each side and at the back of the house. The consciousness of there being people in that bush, so silent, so quiet, as silent and quiet as the ruined house on the hill, made me uneasy. There was no sign on the face of nature of this amazing tale that was not so much told as suggested to me in desolate exclamations, completed by shrugs, in interrupted phrases, in hints ending in deep sighs. The woods were unmoved like a mask. Heavy, like the closed door of a prison, they looked with their air of hidden knowledge, of patient expectation, of unapproachable silence. The Russian was explaining to me that it was only lately that Mr. Kurtz had come down to the river, bringing along with him all the fighting men of that lake tribe. He had been absent for several months, getting himself adored, I suppose, and had come down unexpectedly, with the intention to all appearance of making a raid either across the river or downstream. Evidently the appetite for more ivory had got the better of the, what shall I say, less material aspirations.